Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the KE Report Weekend Show. Corey and Chad here, your hosts for this weekend show. A lot for us to cover with U.S. markets continuing to show quite a bit of weakness. Boy, oh boy, this week was dominated with political news, tariffs, mostly focused on tariffs. We also had Trump's speech to Congress. That was a wild ride, if you ask me. And then a lot of economic data ending the week with jobs numbers. But again, these markets seem so focused on tariff news and, quite frankly, watching this correction that these markets are in. We'll call it a correction for now, but who knows how much deeper it could go. In the first half of this show, we're going to focus on the broad averages as well as some of the other sectors like the US dollar, which also seems to be in a bit of a free fall. Also, talking international markets, which are really starting to outperform the US. Back half of the show, we're shifting our focus more into the resource stock sector, recapping some of those conferences in Toronto and some of the opportunities our guests see in some of those equities. We're kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies. Rick writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. This is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail and individual side, I'm sure what a lot of you, our listeners, are interested in, check out In the Know Trader, that website. Rick has two products now, a weekly report called the Tactical Trader Report and a daily report called the Daily Tip Sheet. Rick, let's start off with these markets. As I said, they are in correction mode, not quite at a 10% correction yet, but the S&P down about 7-ish percent from its recent peak. I know a lot of money rotating out of the big name stocks. And Rick, I need to give you some credit that you called the market top. You forecasted it actually months before it came, outlining the level you thought the S&P would top at. Now that we've hit that top, Rick, just give us an overview of, again, what led you to call that top of the market and now how you think this could all play out.
Well, Corey, it goes back to pretty much about July 1st last summer when the S&P was probably trading 550-ish, something like that, the spiders rather. And as we saw strength at the end of June into early July, I had come out with a call telling people that the market would likely top. I had a projection target at 609 and high change, we call it 610, 609, something there. And we hit there first in December. I think it was December 6th was the first time we got to the 609 handle. I think probably 7-8 times we saw highs between, let's call it 605 and what ultimately became the mid-February high at 613, which was only 0.5% above the target. And now we've, you know, fallen like a rock since mid-February. And today we potentially are closing beneath the 200-day moving average for the first time. Qs are beneath theirs already. And I think there's probably, we're getting close. Today's, you know, low is awfully close to what was the July high. And the July high was significant, both for the S&P and for the Qs. The Qs sold off 16% from their July high. The S&P far less, I think, was probably closer to, 7%, something like that. And it's, you know, we've sold off now to where there is some support. I think it wouldn't surprise me if we still tuck underneath this. I'd say for a tactical target, you're talking about below 560s to maybe 558 or so, and the S&P. So that, you know, that's only about 1% lower from here for a potential bounce. But I'm still looking in general that bounces will likely be sold into at this point, I think, north of 590. The S&P would have trouble if it could bounce that much, and anywhere from, 590 to 595, something like that, is the bulk of the resistance right now. And to think the market's still in for some trouble. And part of this is understanding the game of positioning that is out there. And so few investors understand that much of price movement is based upon who and what is positioned where and when. And the fact, if you look at how much buying came in after election night back in November, you know, the big gap up when Trump won, and the amount of volume done over the 3 months that basically traded between spiders, let's call it 585 and 610, and now the breakdown underneath 585 just over a week ago, all those late-to-the-game buyers are completely trapped. And I think it's going to take, you know, a decent amount of time for them to get that money back and the chance to even, you know, get out without a loss on it. Now, if you're a long-term investor, sure, ultimately it should come back. But the question is, how much are you willing to sacrifice on the downside for the hope that it comes back, and, you know, how many years, months, years it would take before that would happen. Some people would tell me, you know, you're crazy. In another week, we can beg you up at 595. And the way things are going right now with the increased volatility and a VIX at 24, and the fact that you have a president who says anything at any time, you know, CEOs don't know what to do right now because they simply don't know what Trump is going to say. And I generally try to keep politics out of this. And I'm not talking if I'm pro-Trump or against Trump. I'm just saying the reality is you have a president who right now is a difficult person for people to try to get an edge on what he's likely going to do, despite that he has said he would do many of these things during his campaign. The fact that they come at any time, any place, he announces tariffs and he pulls back and he pulls back more. You know, he was against ever doing anything with Iran. Now he's talking about possibly coming to the table to discuss things with Iran. You just don't know what and how, you know, what to do with this. So it comes back to understanding, take this out of the equation, all the positioning, who's doing what, how much, you know, where is the smart money and what is smart money doing? So if you turned on the TV to a business channel in the last month or two, you would know that Berkshire Hathaway has more cash than they've ever had. Steve Cohen, owner of the Mets, who has his, you know, 0.72 hedge fund, is negative the market. Stanley Druckenmiller is negative the market. Now, he's been negative for a while, so he's missed a lot of this. But a lot of smart money has been seeing distribution while the public was buying the last several months, especially since the election. And you know, right now it's panning out that the public bought the top, which they so often do. And you know, there are many times you take, whether it's a CNBC or the like type channels where the public gets a lot of their information, they tend to be, what's the word you need, like carnival barkers, essentially at the top and the bottom, and mostly at the top. So look at how few guests were on who were bearish in the last few months as compared to bullish. And then people who've been bullish pretend like they haven't been bullish because now that the market comes off, they're saying, well, yeah, we saw this and the market's coming off and it could come off more and stuff. And they just try to cover their rear ends for the fact that they are part of the reason that so much of the public is trapped on the top is because they were gung-ho bulls over the last few months and only now are starting to say, oh, yeah, well, maybe we can pull back. That doesn't help anybody. But if you could foresee the distribution and what was actually going on, you had a much clearer signal that smart money was selling as compared to buying. And I think, you know, that's the type of thing that you need to know who you're listening to. And you probably need to spend a heck of a lot less time listening to talking heads on business television who generally are talking their own books and very little else besides that. And there's always the slant towards, you know, the upside. And our work's been showing for months and months, not only where the target would be, but then once we hit it, the distribution over the last few months has been very easy to see. And that rallies have, you know, continually failed north of Spider 600. And now you get the big, you know, this is the third week in a row of like real selling. There's you can easily come up with potential support levels on the way down because we've moved up so much. There are lots and lots of support levels. But if you're going to ask me where I target, and I know you're going to ask me, so I'll just answer it for you. I think we likely get sub 550 on this move. And I give a 30% chance, and this is kind of really out of left field, and more than I ever looked for, because when I first put out the 609 call back in July, I said from there we would fall double percentage points, and it's meaning at least 10%. And my guess is we decline 11% or more. But on an outside chance that things really get much worse, I'd say there's a 30% chance the S&P could fall as low as, I don't know, something under maybe between 490 and 480 in spider terms. And that actually takes out less April's low.
Well, Rick, that's a pretty good setup for where things have been. With the top that you saw, you nailed it there, and you'd given the price target to our audience a couple of times in prior calls, and I appreciate you being one of the voices of reason, not just looking at the technical levels, but also the psychological side of the trading. And, you know, you kind of wove in the post-election sugar high that we saw, and then the talking heads on financial TV saying buy, buy, buy. But I appreciate that your multiple input factors when you look at the markets, you look at the fundamentals, you look at the technicals, you look at the sentiment. But when you see these kind of moves, is there anything that you also would take away from some of the rotation out of some of the tech and growth names and into some other sectors? Because I know you follow a lot of the key spider ETFs in your service. Have you noticed more of a focus from growth to value in some of the sectors that you look at?
Well, sure. In the last 2 months, you've seen a rotation towards cyclical type names. And the biggest beaten down area, which was healthcare, right now is kind of on the best trajectory going forward to potentially actually outperform. It's still not outperforming on a year-over-year basis, but it is certainly improving the most out of any of the beaten down sectors. And along that line, you have materials, REITs, staples, and energy that are at least pointing towards potentially being where you're getting next leadership from. Hard to think that way, but if we get more into a true correction and we get the 10% or more to the downside, you're going to see those are the sectors to look for. And what you wouldn't look for are what the previous leaders were, which were, let's say, the three dominated by the Mag 7 names. So that's XLY, Consumer Discretionary, XLC, Communication Services, and XLK, Tech. So those are kind of headed in the wrong direction. The only one of those three that still is, well, the standout of those three is still XLC. So that's Meta and Google being the two biggest names in those ETFs.
Rick, one of the big picture themes that I've been asking a lot of people about, which also ties into this pretty quick fall in the US dollar, is the potential of the end of this kind of US market dominance when you look around the world. The US markets over the last 10, maybe 20 years have just been absolutely crushing the rest of the world. The dollar has been relatively strong, especially recently. But if we are really seeing this deglobalization, and quite frankly, the US picking fights with a lot of different countries, is there a chance, tying in the dollar and the outperformance that we have seen recently in international markets, that this could be a longer term trend where the dollar loses some of its purchasing power and these other markets that have lagged the US have a longer period of time to play catch up?
I think it's too early to know if that's the case. The dollar this year has been pretty much straight down, this week being the worst of its declines, because last week dollar index closed out at, I don't know, somewhere near 107.5. And right now we're at 103.70. We're down almost four full figures in a single week. Been a long time since the dollar took that, you know, top of fall. Quickly looking, it looks like it could be something like the fall of 2022. The dollar broke out above about 107, 107.5 or so last fall, got to 110, and then so far now it's, you know, sold off. And it's right now, dollar bearishness has gotten pretty decent, such that I actually think that we're pretty close to a real low, for, or at least a trading low. Somewhere around 103.5 is the 62% retracement level of the rally that we saw versus, so this year's high, let's call it 110, to the 2023 low, which was down at 99.5. Right now, here at 103.5, you're kind of at, you know, a major support level, and anywhere from there to 102.5, I'd say, is going to determine whether or not the dollar actually continues falling and comes back and tests the 100 level, which it just bounced off of last year, or is this the bottom of this 2.5 month decline and things turn around and actually extend higher to get towards those 2022 highs, which in the dollar index was above 113. I mean, I have a measured target up to 112 and change. So you're kind of in the middle of nowhere right now, and it's too early to determine if XUS, so whether you look at an ACWI world index like ACWX, an ETF, that's the old world country index for equities excluding the U.S., you get more specific towards looking at, let's say, one of the better European indexes to look at. The ETF is, the ticker is F, like Frank, E, Edward, Z, like zebra, Fez. That ticker is the Euro Stoxx 50, essentially the Dow Jones of European names, the top 50 names in Europe. I'm long that index, and I've trimmed a little. A week ago, I trimmed a little. It's actually up this week, in a week that the S&P is down sharply. So Europe is, for the first time, you know, over the last few months, let's go back to the beginning of this year, Europe is outperforming. And we haven't seen that for a while. And there are periods of time that they do. Longer term, do I think that's likely going to hold? No. Could it last the whole year? Sure, it could. Depends on, you know, how bad things get in the U.S. And again, how the implications of these tariffs, how much will other countries make the determination that they can't count on the U.S. and therefore start making, you know, economic deals with other parts of the world, which could end up being, you know, U.S. competitors like China and, you know, maybe Russia. It depends on the goods and the needs they have. How much does Europe start trading with itself? How much do non-developed markets, emerging markets, you know, start using places other than the U.S.? These are up for grabs. And I think the dollar pullback that we've seen, although pretty darn sharp this year, because it's in the neighborhoods of 6%, something like that, which is pretty dramatic this quickly, it's just too early to tell how lasting this is. And part of that determination is because you have a guy like Donald Trump, for all his good and all his bad, you know, I don't know if he changes his mind every day, but he seems to be the type of guy who just kind of says what he's thinking at any given moment. And I think that's where markets are going to have a harder time dealing with somebody like that, because what he says on Monday could get unwound by Friday that same week. And, you know, how you play that is very difficult.
Yeah, Rick, we've had people on the show mention that we're trading by tweet right now. It can literally change from one day to the next. But in that kind of an environment, do you think that there's a lot of foreign investors that have parked their money in U.S. dollars, but also in the U.S. markets? Are they fanning it out into other foreign markets now? Like your point with Europe, but also some people have made the point with China. Do you think emerging markets will finally start getting a bid? Are we going to see some of these other markets outperform the U.S. market this year?
Well, again, it's going to depend, I think, ultimately on what the real direction in the dollar ends up being. If the dollar keeps falling, sure, you want to buy emerging markets. And from, you know, tacticals or positioning point of view, I can make a small case that, let me see, something like, what's a good proxy? EEM, right, is the popular emerging markets ETF. On the upside in 2024, kind of reached targets. On the downside, at the start of this year, it reached what I call a failed sell signal. And a failed sell signal is bullish in a generally uptrending market. So you know, you can make the case that EM or emerging markets in general can do well, especially if the dollar breaks further. If the dollar holds in here, like I think it might in this mid 103 handle to 102 and a half handle, then these may not have a heck of a lot of upside. I think you're really going to have to wait to see which way the dollar goes.
Okay. Yeah, well, hey, to your point, I think the dollar's down over 3% just this month, and we're only a week through this month, so it really picked up some steam and in a way is kind of overdue for some sort of a bounce. Let's go to some other markets that we like to touch on, gold being one of those. Gold went through a little correction, but that's all it was, a little correction. It's back above 2,900. Obviously, still getting some of that defensive money play. The dollar weakness, I'm sure, helps to keep that dollar higher. A lot of people are saying $3,000 gold is inevitable. It's right around the corner. It's coming tomorrow. However, it hasn't gotten here yet. But look, gold, out of anything, has been pretty stable at these higher levels as these markets have been correcting. What are your thoughts on gold and any life in the gold stocks you're seeing as well?
Yeah, so let's kind of talk about bullion first. I think that gold's going to likely put in its high between 3,000 and 3,100. I've trimmed some at 2,700, which I've had for years and years. So although that trim was right for 2 weeks, and you know, we went from, so when I trimmed at 2,700, we went to 2,800, and then we got to about 2,550 or something like that. So, you know, it was the right time sale, but I wasn't really looking to go back into it. And I could have or should have, I don't know. But I don't think gold has a heck of a lot left right now. It's already hit some really long-term targets. And that doesn't mean it has to stop. But it implies that if you're first buying gold at, you know, 2,900, the likelihood that you have drawdown, or let's say, where's the next $500 up or down? I would tell you it's down. I don't think, if you bought gold at 2,900, I would say you have a much better chance of seeing $2,500 gold than before you'd see $3,400 gold. And that's part of what you need to understand when you buy anything, whether it's gold or a stock, is what's your upside versus your downside? And, you know, where are you in the scheme of all the other players in the market? You know, if you look at the move in gold from, let's call it 2,600 late last fall to all-time highs now, just shy of 3,000. You know, I use futures, so just about 2,975 is the all-time high. Once we put in the high, you have not really seen open interest move up, which means that you've also had much of the buying were shorts getting out to prior longs getting out. So the shorts got squeezed, they were on the losing side, and prior longs were selling out to the shorts who were forced to pay up. You know, open interest has been falling for the last month or so. So that's already indicative of the fact that this move is, you know, in a classic interpretation of market movement, it's being fueled by shorts who are forced to pay and smart money selling out to those shorts. It's not indicative of new money coming into the gold market thinking prices are going well higher. And that's just one of the pieces of the puzzle that I look at when I analyze markets for my institutional clients is, you know, who's doing the buying, who's doing the selling. And it's pretty clear that recently it's shorts getting squeezed out. So that's part of the reason why I don't think gold necessarily has a heck of a lot left in it.
What about the equities, though, Rick? Do you think that they could play catch up to where the gold price is, even if it pulls back a little bit? Because some of them have still underperformed people's expectations and what they would do. But then again, the equities are different than gold. So how are you looking at those separate from gold?
So, you know, for a long time, for years, we've heard that gold equities are terribly undervalued to bullion itself. And yet, you know, since, I don't know, the peak in 2020 of the ratio, if you pulled up a chart of GDX, which is the predominant gold equity ETF, divided by GLD, the popular gold bullion ETF. This peaked in 2020. So it first sold off and made a huge bottom when COVID came out. Then it reversed completely, where GDX took over and had a huge rally versus bullion. But from the middle of 2020, this has basically been every rally you could sell, if you could figure out where to sell. You know, this is just lower highs, lower lows. But the low made right about at the turn to start this year was precisely on the uptrend line that goes all the way back to the big secular low from 2016. That now has 4 points on it. You know, it takes 2 points to draw a trend line. Two more times this ratio has come back to precisely tell you when to buy GDX versus GLD. So for right now, you would lean towards the equities doing better than bullion until that trend line really gave way. But we have not seen any sustainable rally in GDX versus GLD. I mean, sometimes it lasts a year, but it has not been a bigger, longer-term trend where so many people have gone into looking for a gold equities to outperform, and they just haven't for, you know, several years in totality. So near-term, yeah, I'd still lean towards GDX doing better than GLD. But also do remember that GDX, you know, you're still talking equities and the equity market's under some pressure now. But just looking at those two against each other, I'd give a slight edge to owning the gold equity as compared to bullion.
Interesting. Okay, so hey, maybe gold moves sideways, maybe it corrects a little bit more, but the equities do okay in that environment. Rick, one other point that people have brought up looking at something like GDX, even GDXJ, is that the volumes have been quite low in those ETFs. Do you put any weight in that? Should we be paying attention to volumes?
You know, you don't need to if your goal is making money. If you can figure out when to buy and when to sell, what's the difference how much volume was behind it?
What about showing interest in the sector, though? I like your comment there. That's a great comment, that if you're out to make money, who cares about volume? But what about showing potential interest or the increase that could be possible in interest?
Yeah. All right. So let's compare volume now since 2020 from 2015 to 2020, right? So we look back 10 years. For sure, the first five of those 10 years did far more volume than doing now. Which means, yes, in general, less interest in the sector. Part of the reason less interest in the sector, you had cryptos come around. So that took money out of people looking at the gold market. And you had let's just use generically Mag 7 type names that really drew money into those names, whereby, you know, if you're in gold names, usually it's just a fraction of your portfolio. You have far less, generally, unless you are running a gold fund, you have far less in GDX and GLD and just, let's call it, gold and gold-related exposure. When the market's flying and you've got names that, you know, look at NVIDIA 5 years ago and where it's priced now, right? Look at Microsoft, look at Apple, I mean, that's what you want to make money. It all comes down to what's your goal? Where do you want to make money? And, you know, I think of gold the way I probably thought about it 30, 40 years ago when I first got into the industry, which is, you know, it's a hedge against inflation. You should have, you know, a small percent of your overall portfolio there, just kind of as a hedge. It's done well for sure since, you know, 2000, the last 25 years, it's pretty much matched what the S&P has done, which is phenomenal. But people don't have 20% of their portfolios in gold and gold equities. They just don't. So it's a smaller piece of the puzzle just to begin with. And when you have the global coverage that the last few years have brought to Mag 7 type names, but why are you looking to hope to make 3 or 4% in gold if you can make 100% in, you know, something on the equity side. So it's all part of the puzzle too, is the last 5 years, gold's probably, you know, GDX volume's probably half of what it was from the prior 5 years. But that doesn't stop the market. Look at a GDX chart. It goes up and down. It's choppy as all hell, just like it was in the past. So no listener is going to be affected by the fact that there's half as much volume as there was in the past. You'll be able to buy and sell anything you need to do whenever you need to do it. A bigger picture of saying, yeah, there's less interest in this. And a lot of that is because of crypto.
Well, Rick, I appreciate you breaking that down. We do have people in our audience that probably have a bigger allocation to the precious metal sector than your typical generalist investors do. And some of them make the point that if you look at things since the turn of the century, after the dot-com bubble burst, you know, 99, 2000 and forward, that gold has still outperformed the equities. And even this year, gold has outperformed the general equities. And really, it depends on where you start your measuring stick, like always. But there's some people that just have a bigger allocation. But I think you're right that a lot of the last 5 to 10 years have been a change in tone over to other sectors that are hot, the tech sector and the cryptos. I'd love you to weigh in on the cryptoverse and Bitcoin. Some people have an outsized allocation to that as well that are just diehards in that sector. I know you only keep a small allocation, but how are you looking at something like Bitcoin?
So you heard me say it on your show months ago that the upside target I had for Bitcoin, and I use futures as my proxy, was 108,800. And what's the all-time high? 110. 110,150. All right, so same thing, 1% away, give or take, was a number I came out with months and months before we ever got there. It's got a big rounding, you know, same thing, post-election, huge rounding distributive top, and then into, I guess, about a week and a half ago or so, you know, futures got down to 78,330, which closed the gap from election night. So now we got as high as 95,000 about a week ago when we had that good news where Trump said, you know, he's going to do make the crypto strategic fund. But we opened pretty much on the high and closed on the low that day, and we haven't done anything since then. So you still have months of trapped buyers. Same way, if the chart's similar to the S&P since election night. You had the huge run-up right after election day, a big distributive top that lasted, I don't know, 3 to 4 months, and now the move down. So you have trapped people above. You've got good news out in the crypto space that did not act positively in the market. So for me now, you need to get weekly closes or, well, certainly several daily closes above, let's say, 93,005 and a quarter in order to think that this thing has any chance to move back up. But I'd say right now, just based on positioning, the public again bought the top, and right now they're kind of trapped. So, I mean, there's major support down near, I don't know, let's call it 70,000, something like that, down to 63. I'd hope not to see that. I have just because I have a very small position myself out of my whole portfolio. I'm not even at, I think, 1%. And in hindsight, I guess it would have been better if I had 20% in crypto from years ago. Because, I mean, if you weren't Bitcoin, you know, you would have done phenomenally. But I still don't necessarily buy the story to it. So I have some, and I've made some money in it. But right now, based on positioning, kind of, you know, you have a fair amount of people trapped. And I'm not sure what the catalyst is going to be to untrap those people, given that the news is already out that Trump is, you know, thinking of this whole strategic reserve with cryptos. So it's going to need something else to happen in order to see Bitcoin get back up to its all-time highs.
I'm with you, Rick. That signing of that order this week and seeing crypto sell off on the back of that, I think that was a real wake-up call, or it should have been, to a lot of traders really playing the crypto space. I understand having an allocation to it, but look, that I thought would be a huge driver. It was when it was first announced, but now when the pen met the paper, traders went a different direction. Very interesting to see those market moves.
I mean, let me just say, I bought $85,000 and sold the open. When was it? Last Friday when that announcement came, it was 95. So I made a quick, you know, it's a fraction. I didn't buy a full Bitcoin. So it's not like I laid out $85,000 and made 10 grand on it. I bought a fraction of Bitcoin. I played a quick trade. But when I look at the bigger picture, I know it's supposed to, you know, your crypto bulls are saying it's going to be $250,000. People say it's going to be $1 million. I have no clue. But right now, there's a lot of people trapped in this. Months of buyers with no likely exit to not lose money on this.
Hey, so interesting. Rick, hey, we've taken up a lot of your time, but boy, oh boy, do I find it always interesting and always insightful chatting with you. Again, if you want to learn more about Rick's retail and individual letters, visit the In the Know Trader website. I will post that link in the show notes of the weekend show. You can sign up for the Tactical Trader Report or the Daily Tip Sheet. If you have any further questions, feel free to email either Shad or I about Rick's services. So Rick, always great chatting with you. Thanks for taking time with us today. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
You too, guys. Thanks for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.